ways of test equipment right now because of the cost factor, even though you could buy a scope very cheap. And learning how to use a scope, which is another thing. You see, that opens up a whole new branch of discussion. First, you have to know what an oscilloscope does and how it works and how to use it, even before you use it for troubleshooting. You have to know what you're looking for. You know, you have to know the graticules. You have to know how to set up the voltages and the time base and so on. So that opens up a whole other discussion. So you can see it just branches out. It keeps branching. But look, I started with this. Let's go from here and see how it leads next week. But it's a, as I said, I'm kind of like just making this up as I go along. Part for memory, part for experience, and part for both. All right, with that, it's after 10 o'clock already. I don't want to take up too much more time. Thanks a lot, and for everybody for listening. And we can get into this deeper next week. And if anybody has any questions on the subject or topic, specifically to a troubleshooting problem, let me know, and then we can talk about that too. All right, thank you. And catch you guys next week. WHCDL. Go ahead, Roy.
AC2GS. Thank you very much, Andy. That was a very enjoyable addition to Andy's Corner, and I really, really, really look forward to next week's presentation as well. This gives a good eye over the shoulder of a A-plus technician. So I'm enjoying it endlessly. So I thank you for that.
Thank you.
Well,
to be continued. See you later.
Okie doke. I hope we haven't delayed Bob, KD2UQK. He had a question. So please, Bob, I see you on Echo Link, so you're still around, hopefully. What's your question tonight?
Yeah, sorry, I'm still here. Sorry about the delay between transmissions. It takes a second for Echo Link to catch up. It was a great Andy's Corner. Thank you very much. So my question is, I'm using a single coax line. Let me describe the situation. I'm using a single coax line coming from my antenna on the roof. I'm feeding two receivers. One's an SDR, one's an iGate with a built-in receiver chip. I'm splitting that with an old Verizon 1-in, 2-out coax splitter with 3.5 dB of isolation. I'm wondering do you have any suggestions to get sensitivity any bit better? Because what I've been told is if you're splitting two receivers off of one line, you're kind of desensing each other with the one line. But that's what I'm trying to eliminate with the Verizon coax splitter that has some isolation. Do you have any suggestions on how to mitigate desense between those on a single line, right?
Okay, I'm a little confused by the desensing term. Desensing is what happens when a nearby transmitter off frequency interacts with the front end of a radio and decreases its sensitivity. You basically, by definition, the most efficient splitter known to mankind is going to take 50% of the signal into one radio and 50% in the other, which is a 3 decibel drop. So the best filters in the world, a splitter is going to give you a 3 dB drop in the signal strength. That by itself has nothing to do with desensing. If there's no transmitter anywhere around, if you were somehow transmitting in addition to that, there would be desense. But you would have much more problems if you tried to transmit through that splitter, because that splitter most likely is not designed to deal with more than a milliwatt or a microwatt. So you'd burn out the darn splitter. So I'm not quite sure if using that term that you used is kind of correct. Again, the best that you could get with a 2-to-1 splitter is a 3 decibel drop in signal strength. You'd have to set up two separate antennas in order not to have that happen to you.
Okay, yeah, maybe I'm using the wrong terminology. All right, I was told from other sources that I was getting a defense. Maybe that's wrong. All right, well, I guess that does it for my question. I guess I'm just maybe I'm using the wrong thing, and it's a combination of the wrong information. All right, well, thanks, sir. That clears that up a little bit. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And just because it says that it's a 3 decibel drop splitter, unfortunately doesn't necessarily mean that it is. I don't know how much that splitter cost you. I've bought some, I think they were Diamond or Comet splitters. They're mostly distributed in Japan. I think I got mine through eBay or something. They were about $60-$70. So, you know, how much you spend on a splitter tends to reflect to a degree the lack of a loss at UHF and VHF frequencies. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. So we have a few more minutes if anyone has any questions related to any technology or science or even general medical questions. We don't give medical advice to individuals. But if you have any questions for the remaining short amount of time that we have available, please hit that push-to-talk button.
KD2BDW.
Yes, Mike.
Just a quick question, if KD2VHD is still out there.
Out here, KD2VHD, Jim.
I didn't want to break in before to slow down the net, but you said the TX500, which is the Lab 599. I'm wondering if you own that radio or you plan to buy that radio.
Tough answer. I own the radio, and I think I blew it up. I sent it back for him to take a look at it. No fault of theirs. I think it's a good machine. But I haven't learned it yet. I got high hopes.
Okay, thank you. My email is good on QRZ, KD2 Victor Delta Whiskey. If you could shoot me a note, I would love to hear your experiences about that radio.
I haven't signed up for that yet. And I'm a little early in the game to give you some feedback. Other than that, it looks hopeful. I got a problem I got to solve, but that's I'll get past that. But it's a neat machine. No doubt about it. It's a neat machine. It's really cool.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Roy. I just didn't want to break the net before asking him that when he mentioned the radio. So back to you, Roy. Thank you again.
You're welcome, Mike. Anytime. Once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. Anyone with any other questions or comments before we move on to our next segment?
WA2MHL. The name is Bob.
Yes, Bob.
Yes, sir. If you could just please give us a quick explanation as to why do we still have to wear masks? I got my full vaccination and everything, but there are people, you know, I can understand if you don't have a vaccination, why are we wearing masks?
Okay, Bob. Well, as far as the CDC is concerned, when you're outside, you no longer have to wear a mask. If you're inside, there are some niggling questions, if you will, about whether or not the vaccination protects you from an infection entirely or protects you from symptoms and complications of an infection. If it's the second, then it is theoretically possible that vaccinated people can become infected, and although asymptomatic, they can act as shedders for other people in the area. So that's the underlying concept at this point in time for the mask still, that even though you can't catch anything, it's vaguely possible that you can spread it to other people. I hope that that serves the answer as time goes on. Hopefully, and they show significant evidence that most people who are vaccinated do not shed the virus under any circumstance, this too shall pass.
Thank you, Dr. 73.
You're welcome, Bob. You know, these are trying times, as I mentioned often. You know, we are seeing light at the end of the tunnel. And thankfully for us, it is not the light of an oncoming train, which is not what I would say if I was unfortunately in India right now, that's having terrible, terrible problems, and I hope that we can help them out with that somehow. Anyway, any other questions or comments before we move on to the next episode? Very well. Once again, I just want to remind everyone that if you have any questions or if you have any topics you'd like to hear discussed, or if you want to share some puzzles that I can then share with the rest of the crew, the way to reach me, and if you want me, I can tap Paul on the shoulder and have him look at something space-related, NASA-related, and perhaps make a comment. The email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at, my call sign is alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. Links are available to a whole bunch of very interesting articles at your leisure. They'll be up all the time. You just go to your browser and type in roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll take you there. And I want to remind people always that MyKC2NJI has archives of many of these technical nets that go as far back as September of 2006. So take a look at that at your leisure, amateurradio.tv. It's an interesting site. There's a lot of wisdom from a lot of silent keys who, although they have shuffled off this mortal coil, they were kind enough to leave us recordings of their advice, which is very, very useful to this day and for many, 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 many years to come. So please avail yourself of it. Anyway, it's been fun, guys. I look forward to what comes next. I will hereby summon Paul, WS2N, for the SpaceNet Report.
AC2GS, WS2N, very good. And I hope Andy does... that same topic for the next. It's very, very interesting. And the COVID number, I keep track. You know, we used to have the COVID net on this frequency when this all started. And I've been keeping track of the number. Now with Long Island is down to 1.4. New York City, 1.6. They're very low numbers, Roy.
Yes, we're doing good. Like I said, we're approaching that final light at the end of the tunnel here. Now, you know, people can still make really foolish decisions and do foolish things, but we're hoping for the best. And I exhort everyone, please, unless there's some kind of really good reason, if you're able to become vaccinated, please do. Because you're not only protecting yourself, you're protecting others, your loved ones, your families, your neighbor, everyone. So please, please, please get vaccinated.
Yeah, I agree. Very good for it. And I think that helps change these numbers, of course. So I think they're going to stay that way, too, if people keep getting vaccinated. Yeah, okay. As far as the SpaceNet report, let me start in with what happened last week, unfortunately, with Michael Collins. He passed away. Michael Collins was on Apollo 11, and he was one fellow that stayed on board Columbia as it went around, Columbia as it went around the moon, as the Eagle went down with Armstrong and Aldrin to walk on the moon. So, he was really famous for that. I mean, there were other moon landings. There were five other moon landings after that, and each one lasted longer and longer. So it got to the point where the last fellow was left. You know, he stayed up in the command module for a couple of days, but everybody remembers Michael Collins is the one that spent all that time by himself going around and around. But, you know, we lost him at 90 years old. He lived in Florida, and he was one of the good guys. He always pushed for the advancement of the space program. And people don't realize he was also on Gemini 10. You know, we had a Gemini program before Apollo. You know, there were 10 such missions in Gemini, and he was on one of them. He was the pilot on Gemini 10, and John Young was the commander. And back then they were trying to practice to see if they could dock with something. So they used to launch the Agena rocket. They launched that from another launch pad, launch complex 14, and then the Geminis would launch on 19. So one would go up, and then they would go and chase it in the Gemini rocket. And the reason for that is the Agenas had batteries on them. They really weren't solar-powered, and they had a limited lifespan, so they would launch right away instead of waiting days on end to launch. And they'd catch up with the Agena. The idea was to dock with it and see how they did. And that was the first real successful docking, what Michael Young and John Young did back then on Gemini 10. You know, they docked with the Agena rocket. And then they were practicing, you know, using another rocket to change the elevation of their orbit, the altitude. And they needed to do that because, you know, they needed to know that if they redocked with something, another rocket could help them, you know, either get out of Earth orbit or out of lunar orbit. So all this was, you know, planned. They needed to do EVAs. He did an EVA as well. But when they docked with that Agena rocket, they lit up the engine again on the Agena, which pushed the two craft up to a much higher orbit. I think they got up to around 400 miles instead of 180 miles, you know, in altitude. So they just proved that would work. And then after a while, they reignited the Agena again and brought themselves back down to a lower orbit, so without using any fuel from the Gemini spacecraft. So Michael Collins did the EVA. He went outside. He took a piece of test equipment that was attached to the Agena and brought that back into the spacecraft, and he became quite popular with NASA at the time, and then he was one of the people that they wanted to send up on Apollo 11. By the way, John Young, he went on to eventually land on the moon himself. He orbited the moon first, and then he eventually was one of the people that did land and walk on the moon. So really interesting times back then. Let me drop it, and we'll go on. This is WS1. Okay. The main news
that if anybody watches news or listens to the radio, they talked about the crew coming back from the International Space Station early in the morning today. So, you know, you had a successful landing in the night, actually a night landing. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning in the Gulf of Mexico. Originally, it was planned for the Atlantic Ocean, but they always have a backup in the Gulf of Mexico due to the weather and the winds and high waves. They delayed it a couple of days, and eventually they realized that this would be the best time. So it was actually the first time they did a night splashdown, not a lot of night landing. The shuttles just do quite a few night landings, but it was the first splashdown since Apollo 8. Apollo 8 is the one that went to the first spacecraft that went around the moon and then eventually came back without landing on the moon. But they landed in the Pacific Ocean. But this group landed in the Gulf of Mexico. On board, there were four hams: Michael Hopkins, KF5LJG, Victor Glover, KI5BKC, Shannon Walker, KD5DKB, and Tsuchi Noguchi from the Japan Aerospace. KD5TVP. So they successfully brought four hams back to safety, and all went well. They said it was a perfect, disconnect from the space station and a day in transition before the landing, which is very good to see. And by now they're all back in Houston, so that went well. And they were replaced by another crew that's up there. When they left, there were 11 people on board, and now there's 7 people on board. This is another crew, Dragon crew. They call it number 2, and this was number 1 of the regular missions that are being flown by SpaceX. Right now, they've been paid or they're guaranteed 6 flights to the space station so far. They've done 3-man flights, but the first one was a test flight. But this is the second operational flight, and they'll have 4 more. And I'm sure NASA will foot the bill for future missions as well. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. They said it was a pinpoint landing. Came very close to the ship. Years ago, when they came back, from the moon or Gemini or even Mercury, you'd have an aircraft carrier out there, and they'd eventually bring them back to the aircraft carrier. Now SpaceX has their own ships, and they pick up the capsule right out of the water. And then once it's on the deck, they open the doors, and the crew comes out. So that's how that works. So we'll be looking forward to the next flight up there. Again, it will be SpaceX. Boeing is still not ready with their Starliner vehicle, unfortunately. They say they're ready, but because of the scheduling of different flights, and the amount of time they spend up there, for instance, this crew was up there for 6 months. That separates the time frame. So my guess is Starliner won't be able to go up until early next year sometime. And when they go up, they'll first go up with a crew of 3, and eventually they'll go up with a crew of 4 as well. And then we'll have two spacecraft from the United States that will be capable of docking with the space station. Let me drop it. Okay, one of the articles that I saw from NASA, NASA, there's a lot of websites that send information back. I like NASA because of a number of reasons. They're accurate in what they say. Of course, there's no commercials. There's no advertisements on the NASA site, which is really nice. But they, you know, the other day they sent down, they sent a picture of two of the people that just came back, Shannon Walker and Noguchi. And like I said, all four were hams, but they have a picture of two of them in front of the ham radio inside of Columbus, the Columbus module. Columbus module is the European Space Agency contribution to the International Space Station. So it's one of the 15 different modules that are attached to the space station. And that's where our ham radio is located. You know, Ares set that up years ago. And they have a 25-watt Kenwood up there now. And they show a picture of the two of them on the ham radio. And one of the sentences that NASA put out was, the ISS ham radio also serves as a backup communication network between the International Space Station crew and NASA, which is, nice to see. If anybody wants it, I should have sent the link over to Dr. Roy, because, you know, you click on that, you see the picture, and you actually see this one paragraph. They got a couple of paragraphs about these two, but that one paragraph says a lot. That it is used for backup communication, which I've heard of in the past. And actually, they did use it one time on a Mir space station. But it's actually part of NASA. It's not just something to, you know, for educational, for the kids, although really that's the way it goes. You know, they talk to all the schools. But it is an actual backup system for NASA. It's required for that. And it's, you know, it might be good to show a relative that's interested in you know, you say you're a ham radio operator, and you know, they have a radio on a space station, and, you know, what's that good for? And, you know, you tell them, well, they could use that as a backup. And here it actually says that, you know, instead of just telling somebody. I thought that was pretty good anyway. Any questions or comments? Okay, nothing heard. Another topic has to do with the Ingenuity helicopter. And that was brought up by the Perseverance rover to Mars, which I've been talking about, it seems like, endless, you know, for years now. Talking about the development of it the last 6 years and whether or not it was going to work, the testing, and eventually the approval of NASA to put it on the bottom of the rover, the belly of the rover, before the rover lands. And that all was successful, and then eventually pyrotechnics cut it loose, and it folds down with a little motor. And, you know, how this legs, you know, open up, and it actually drops down a couple of inches and lands on the surface of Mars. The rover has to move out of the way because it's solar-powered, and, you know, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Here's these 2 4-foot-long blades that spin counterclockwise to one another. And there's 8 motors involved on this little, it's only a 4.5-pound rover on Earth. It's 1/3 that weight on Mars. And it's got 8 little motors. It's, you know, each blade has 3 little servo motors, and then 2 big motors, one on the very top, you know, right below the solar panel that's there. One motor looking down, and that's the one that spins up the top blade to 2,400 RPMs. And then there's another motor situated on the shaft, but below it, you know, looking up, attached to the other rotor, which makes it also spin that same speed, but in an opposite direction. I think they're stepper motors. But anyway, the plan was to eventually fly it, and starting last week they did. They flew one flight right at the end of last week's net, and since then they've flown three more flights. So they've got four more. They've got four flights already done. Each one getting more and more, let's say, risky. Original one went straight up, straight down. The next one went up, translated to the left a few meters, came back to the same locations, went and landed in the same place. Then the next one went, you know, as far as half the distance of a football field. Now at number four, they lifted off and they doubled the speed. Instead of going like 4 miles per hour in one direction, they upped it to eight, or I think they said 8.5 miles per hour. They give it both in meters and miles per hour. But anyway, they doubled the speed, which means they could double the distance. This thing went like almost 500 feet in one direction, and it came back 500 feet. That's a long way. And the time has increased. Originally it was, you know, 45 seconds or something. Now they're up to 2 minutes, 117 seconds to be exact. But, you know, it's going longer and longer. They're going faster. They're turning more. When it goes as fast as it does, 8 miles an hour, it has this camera on the bottom that's taking pictures of the ground. It's a terrain navigation camera. It's black and white, but it goes the same speed as your TV, 30 frames per second, and each frame it's taking a picture, and it's sending it to a computer and evaluating it, and looking for rocks. Looking for a possible landing spot, and on this last mission, they're evaluating that information now, because they keep coming back and landing in the exact same landing spot that they took off. Now they're going to go further, and they're going to land in a new landing spot. And when they're doing this now the rover is too far away, and it's not getting the pictures of the helicopter flying, but they are getting the data back. They're getting the black and white pictures from the navigation cam looking straight down, and also getting color pictures from the horizontal cam that's looking out. They could rotate the thing to any direction that they want. They've done that to a certain degree, literally. One time they wanted to go turn it 96 degrees, and that's what they did. Let me drop it. Anyway, again, on the internet, you can find pictures that the ingenuity took, and one picture shows perseverance in the distance and different things that, you know, that they're looking at, and each one has a story behind it. But now that they're able to go further and land into a different location, the science team has gotten together with the engineering team, and they said, you know, let's go a little further. Now, they were supposed to stop at flight number five, which they haven't done yet. But now flight number five, they actually want to look for different locations of maybe something that Perseverance, the rover, might be interested in. When they finish the area that they're in, you know, it might drive to this new area. Us going from an experimental helicopter to what they call an operational one, working with Perseverance. And the way I'm reading it, they're going to just keep it going as long as possible. I mean, they were supposed to go up to flight number five, and that was it. Come hell or high water, they were going to stop this, and it was going to get all turned over back to the rover team and the science, and start going looking for rocks and core drilling different samples and leaving them behind as they went, getting ready for the sample return mission that's going to be flown up there in a few years from now. So now it looks like they're going to keep Ingenuity in operation for a little longer. I hope they keep using it. It's amazing. It's amazing that it's able to charge up so good. It sits there in the daytime for 2 days. two nights. Of course, it's charging in the daytime, and it's able to charge up these six little lithium-ion batteries. And it's enough power to not only, you know, fly the helicopter for now that they're up to 2 minutes at a time, for that period of time, it also has to keep the electronic circuits in this cube warm. So they come on at night, and so you're now using the energy for the heater, you're using it for flying, and of course you're using it for transmitting. They transmit on 915 megahertz, by the way, over to the robe, and I have a range of a little over 3,000 feet. I think it's 3,300 feet is the estimated range. They can't go that far away from the robe, but you know, 3,500 feet is far, you know. But they get, you know, it does have that kind of a range. So we'll see how it goes in the future. It's probably the most successful thing I've ever seen there that they've flown on a spacecraft. You know, with no bugs. I mean, there's one little bug problem that they have, and it has to do with, you know, they send the program up, okay, we want you to do this, or program, you know, gets installed into Ingenuity, and then, you know, when it's time for it to take off, you know, they tell the time it's going to take off, the time it's going to land. You know, nothing's being joysticked from Earth, you know, not 100 million miles away from Earth. So, you know, this is, you know, this is what they do. But the software had a problem where once in a while it would shut it down because, you know, it's confused with the flight program that it used to have on the way to Mars and the new program that it has. You know, they delete everything and then they put the operational program in. Apparently a piece of the flight program must be still in there, some kind of a glitch, and at one time it didn't take off. And actually twice. In the beginning they knew they had the problem. They fixed it, but then at flight number three they had the same problem. It was flight number four, this last one. They had the same problem, and apparently they know how to fix it. But there's a 15% chance that it could happen again. So, you know, even if they fly mission after mission, sooner or later it might happen again, but they do know how to get by it. It just doesn't take off, and they're just waiting until the next day or two. Any questions about Ingenuity? I just want to talk about the designation that it got. Let me drop it. Yeah, Ingenuity got the designation location, you know, like it's a real airport on Earth. So, what the heck was that? I'm trying to think of the name of the group. Frank sent us a message about it. Let me find it here. I can't find it. Anyway, they have a designation that's an international group that says, you know, Kennedy Airport is this, or L.A. is LAX. Well, now they gave Mars location, Jezero Crater. That's where they're located. And they gave that a designation as well. And so, you know, they have this airfield. They're calling it the Wright Brothers Airfield. And they gave it a designation. And in the future, you know, when future Mars craft land there, and there will be one that will actually be landing there, they're going to refer to that designation. Once something else does land there, so that's actually been approved. I was looking for letters that they gave it, but I can't seem to find it. I'll find it later tonight. Anyway, when Mars sample return mission lands there, they'll be able to use that But it's a formal thing, and I know Frank asked this, WB2BXL, and that's the answer. Let me drop it for a while anyway, because I know it takes him a while to get through on Echo.
WB2BXL here. Yeah, I thought it was very interesting to give an airport designation, and that sounds like it could have some ramifications for the future, since Elon Musk is trying to say he wants to declare Mars an independent country, and here the U.S. federal government has an official airport there. So I find it, I don't know whether this was done just for fun or whether somebody was thinking about the future on this. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, Frank. No, they were serious about it. Because, you know, again, I did see it on a NASA website. You know, if I don't see that on NASA, then, you know, I'll question it. You know, anybody can write anything on the other websites. But NASA's pretty good. So, yeah, they called it JZRO. So Juliet, Zulu, Romeo, Oscar. I found it. For Jezero Crater, for Wright Brothers, it's the Wright Brothers Field. That's the designation, and the group that you were talking about. You sent me the letters ICAU. That's the International Civil Aviation Organization, and then you know it's international. So they're not fooling around. That's serious. You know, it's going to happen in the future. You know, you're going to actually have different landings in Mars, on Mars. Eventually, they're going to have, you know, airports of some sort. One, you know, who knows? I mean, right now, NASA is actually considering some kind of a glider. You know, they've actually tested this glider. And they plan on eventually maybe putting out a balloon, you know, after it lands on Mars, you know, have the balloon take this glider up to altitude and release it and fly around and you know, from extremely high heights to send information back. Unfortunately, I don't know how the landing, you know, they could land it, but, you know, it's not going to be taking off again. You know, but, you know, they talked about a series of these things, so maybe they'll have half a dozen balloons, you know, every now and then, you know, launch another one. I'm not sure what they're thinking, but they're testing the vehicle. It's a triangular shaped vehicle. They send it up with it looks like a small Cessna plane, unmanned. It's a UAV, small, you know, propeller operated Cessna type plane, and they fly it up to altitude, and then they release this triangular gliding plane. And it flies around for a while and eventually comes back down land. And they tested that, I think, 2 years ago. Well, I think it was 2017, so maybe a little longer, 3 or 4 years ago. And I don't know if they're still working on it. But after the success of Ingenuity, you never know, they might want to do that. Now, I did hear one of the engineers that are heavily involved with this program talking about launching helicopter. They think they could scale it up to around 55 pounds, and you could put a 55 pound payload inside one of these helicopters. Not sure the blades are going to be a lot bigger, but they've already been working on that idea before Ingenuity went up. Now this thing weighs 4 pounds. We're talking about a 55 pound payload, and he's talking to the scientists, you know, what scientific equipment do you want in this thing? You know, what, you know, you want cameras, spectrometers, you know, alpha neutron detectors, you know, what do you want? And, you're allowed up to 55 pounds, and we'll design this helicopter eventually to go to Mars. So that's the story on Ingenuity. Any other comments or questions?
B2EAB.
WB2BAB. Go ahead.
it's EAV, Ed Ball. I have a question. You were talking about they assigned an airport code in accordance to ICAO standards. You know, airport codes and aircraft tail numbers follow the same call sign rules to an extent that ham licenses do. I believe you said it starts with Julia Zebra, which is assigned to Indonesia. So I can see that being a problem, or I may miss. But, you know, if you look at any plane registered in the United States, it starts with N for November, which is a valid call sign. Ground stations start with the letter K, like Republic is KFRG. These are assigned first letters. If you see a British Airways plane, the tail number always starts with a G. Sound familiar? So I'm a little confused about this JZ for Mars.
Okay, well, JZ would be for Jezero Crater. You know, that's where they're getting the letters from. Whether that conflicts with what we're doing here on Earth, I don't know. I've never paid that much attention to this until this came up. But yeah, they have, it's called the Wright Brothers Field Designation. Juliet, Zulu, Romeo, Oscar. So Jezero is, you know, it's spelled J-E-Z-E-R-O. So they're taking the J and the Z, and then the last two letters of Jezero, R and O, to come up with that. But I guess they feel, well, there's not going to be any conflict with Mars and Earth, you know. I mean, the closest they're ever going to be together is 30 million miles. What do you think? I don't know. Back to you.
I understand your point totally. I agree with you 100%. But I am concerned that if you're going to play that game, it is a violation of the rules. You know, academic, obviously, of course it's not going to come up. But I'm just saying I'm a little surprised, like ICAO would go along with something like that. They tend to be very, 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 you know, ramrod, straight, you know, if you know what I mean.
Okay. The engineers that program Ingenuity, you know, they're considered the people that are flying this thing. So just like you're flying a UAV, you know, you're flying a drone, it has to be licensed. Anyway, this group, I guess it's the same group, the ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization. I'm assuming it's them. They give you or tell you you have to have a logbook. So they now have logbooks, the engineers themselves at Jet Propulsion Laboratory for NASA have logbooks, and now they have Flight 1, and they're putting in this information, you know, the code for Wright Brothers Field, you know, the JZRO, Flight 2, Flight 3, and I guess they're going to go on and on with that. And when sample return mission shows up, you know, and that thing is coming down for a landing, we're getting ready to take off, I guess they could refer to, it's going to be roughly the same location. They could refer to this, you know, maybe in their log, who's ever in charge of this. But it's interesting, you know, you have to call it something, but maybe they should have gave it a different letter. Started off with maybe an M, you know, something that we don't use, or maybe M is taken, I don't know. Isn't that Mexico or something? Back to you.
I have the list there, because it's the same as, you know, the M call signs. M is assigned to United Kingdom, Great Britain, and Northern Ireland. Yeah, it's pretty well taken up. But, and by the way, ICAO does that sort of stuff. By the way, every pilot has to maintain a log. My son is a recreational pilot. And if you just say idly, October 4th, 2019, did you fly? What'd you do? and he'll look it up in his log, and he'll say, oh, yeah, I flew. I took tail number umpty-ump-umpty-ump from here to there, blah, 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 blah. It's a mandatory requirement.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. That's good. Remember we used to have logs that were mandatory for amateur radio?
Well, I stopped logging my 2 meter repeater contacts as soon as I no longer had to, but I still log my low band stuff. I might want to know, oh, did I work this guy about a year ago? Comes in very handy.
Absolutely, I do that. I don't care if it's single sideband or CW, but yeah, I log them all. Gets a little confusing for field day, but, you know, because I have a separate paper for that. You know, if you're operating Delta for home or something, and you, next thing you know, you got 50 contacts, then I just keep a separate paper for that. But, yeah, I have the regular logbooks that ARRL sent you. I still use them. Very good. All right, let me continue on here anyway. This is WS2N, unless you have another comment.
I'm done, WB2EAV, going back into listening mode.
WB2EAV, WS1. Thanks for all of that. And, yeah, okay, I was going to talk about China and their operation, what they've been doing lately. Some things are good, and some things are not. First of all, the good thing, China has named their rover, which will eventually land on Mars, hopefully in May, called so it's actually spelled Zhurong, but it's pronounced Turo. So this rover, they plan on disconnecting from the mothership. Right now it's in orbit around Mars sometime this month, probably late in the month, I would think. And then they're going to go down with the lander, land somewhere. I haven't found that yet where they're going to be landing. They made that determination with their camera. They have a high-rise camera on the orbiter. And once they land, that lander will stay in operation. It's got, you know, weather on it, weather capabilities, definitely communications and cameras and all of that. It does have the rover, though. It's got this, I think it's a 400-pound rover, something like that. Anyway, it has solar panels, and they hope to get 3 months or so out of it. So we'll see. If they succeed, they'll be the second country to operate a rover on Mars. And the only other country was us, and we're up to number five and counting. You know, we had Sojourner, that one that was about the size of a toaster, back in '97. We had the two solar panels, rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, which were supposed to last 3 months. One lasted 6 years. Spirit went 6 years. The other one went 14 years. And then we've had, they both landed in 2004 in January. And then we had Curiosity, and that landed in 2012. And that's still riding around very, very happily with its RTG, radioisotope turbo electric generator, producing 109 watts every hour. So it keeps it running, and keeps recharging the batteries as well. And the same system is now being used for Perseverance. And Perseverance, of course, has only been up on Mars since February 18th this year. So the China has a ways to catch us. They have to succeed first. We're on five rovers, going on six. The sample return mission will also have another rover. That'll be rover number six. And that will be the one that lands and goes around and collects all these different tubes that are going to be laying all over the planet, up to 23, I think they have 43 possible tubes that they could use. I think they're going to use around 23 at least. They plan on caching them, bringing them back to Earth. That should be interesting. So that's the story with China. Unfortunately, China's bad news is they launched a rocket the other day. Their first section of their new space station. So they got that up there. China has had this will be their third version of a space station. They had one up there, it lasted a while. They had a couple of visiting spacecraft go there, and eventually they stopped doing that. And then that thing was out of control, and eventually they weren't too sure where it was going to land because they lost the capability to communicate with it. And then they had the second one go up, and they poked around with it, make sure everything works. And now that third iteration is this one that just went up, which weighs 22 tons, which is like 20 small cars. It's a big module, and a lot of weight, but it successfully got put into orbit, and it's around 41 degree inclination, which is less than the inclination of the space station. Space station, I think it was 51.6. But it's successfully launched it into orbit. Eventually, they plan on launching two more modules to connect to it. The first two space stations that they had was vehicles. The first one to see if they could send a crew to it. The second one was to see if they could send like a progress cargo ship to it, which they did, and they refueled it to see if they could refuel it autonomously, and they did that. And then now this is their main one that they've been working on for decades, really. So it made it to orbit. Unfortunately, the core of the rocket, they have a heavy lift vehicle that puts this in space, called the Long March 5 vehicle, Long March 5B vehicle, and it has four boosters attached to it, the core to it. It went up, the four boosters detached, and that went okay, and the core, was supposed to put up this 22 ton space station, first module, but what they didn't figure on it was they thought the core was going to eventually deorbit itself. It didn't. It just kept going, and now that thing is in orbit, and that thing weighs as much as the space station. It's around the same weight, around 20 tons, and they have people that look at with these telescopes, amateur. I guess I don't know if they're astronomers; they probably are. But they stare at these launches when they go up to try to determine their inclination, or maybe their altitude, or something about them. And they see the booster; they can see it, and it's flickering. So by flickering, they know it's flipping end over end. So they know it's out of control, and China has no way to control it. So now we have this flying thing over our head. That's going to come down who knows where, and they don't know when. Naturally, NORAD is tracking it. They'll probably have a good idea of where it's going to land when it does land. But, theoretically, it could land in a populated area. We have three-quarters of the world is water, but still, it could hit land. The engines will survive. They'll be damaged, but, there's a lot of heat resistant stuff on the engines that will go through the atmosphere no problem. Certain parts of this thing will definitely land